Well, today we're joined by our special guest, someone that we've always enjoyed to talk to learn what's going on with foreign policy, particularly as it pertains with the conflict in Ukraine, because how hard it is to get accurate, reliable information, you know, in our media landscape today. It's great to have a straight shooter like our guest, Colonel Douglas McGregor. How you doing, sir?
Great, David. Great.
Well, it's I want to go through a few of the different stories that are emerging from the conflict. You see, you know, reports. I had a talk with Larry Johnson earlier this week, and he was talking about how the Bakhmut narrative has flipped. It was said to be a very strategically important city in the media and the Western media, and now they've changed to say it's not that big of a deal. Now that it looks like it's pretty much encircled by Russian forces. What's the truth about Bakhmut? I'm hearing that some of the soldiers in Ukraine are, you know, kind of having a lot of weariness about continuing to try to hold their positions in Bakhmut.
Well, Bakhmut has turned into a major bloodbath. We now think we're up over 200,000 Ukrainian dead, and thousands of Ukrainian soldiers have died in this town of Bakhmut. And Larry Johnson's right. Everyone said that this was terribly important for months, and then suddenly said, "Well, this is not that big a deal." In truth, it's a very important city. Understanding once again the terrain and the fact that at least for months at a time you are limited to road travel, the road network in and around Bakhmut is enormously important, and it leads also to railheads, which means that it's a logistical hub. And once this falls, it's going to be very difficult for the rest of the defensive network that runs for hundreds of miles across southern Ukraine to hold together. The other thing is that Zelensky has been moving troops that had been set aside for use in the future as counterattack forces and taken them and thrown them into the Bakhmut bloodbath. With the result, they've taken far, far more casualties. Remember, this Bakhmut is the centerpiece for what I would call this World War I style engagement. It's almost like Verdun, where you have tens of thousands of troops on both sides, and the group on one side has more artillery than the other. I mean, for every one gun the Ukrainians have, the Russians have at least 10. And in the case of Bakhmut of the last couple of weeks, the Ukrainians have simply run out of both guns and ammunition, so they haven't been able to support their troops. Without friendly artillery support, they're simply being destroyed, ground into bits. And many, many Ukrainian soldiers are saying, this is it. We can't survive this. We've got to get out of here. And even though Zelensky's generals have urged him repeatedly, pull the troops out because we'll need them to fight again down the line, he has refused to do so. Now I think Ukrainian soldiers in numbers, who knows how many, are simply falling back on their own, hoping to survive and escape the what they call the cauldron that's being created inside Bakhmut. I don't know how many there are there right now. There are probably no longer 10,000. It's probably less than that, probably between 5 and 10. And the only way for them to escape is across open fields and through woods, which there are plenty of in and around Bakhmut. How many will ultimately reach their own lines? I have no idea, but all the equipment that is there will be abandoned, and eventually it'll essentially be deserted. And it's pretty close to that at this point, but there are still some hanging on. And we've been reading for weeks now reports of Ukrainian soldiers saying, look, we're being hung out to dry. We're not getting food. We're not getting ammunition. We're not being supported with any artillery. And it's hard to evacuate our wounded. Too many men are bleeding to death. It's a horror story on the World War I scale. And so I think the Bakhmut story is about to end. And that's the beginning of a new phase in this war, where the southern defenses completely crumble. And then we begin to inch forward on the Russian side incrementally along the roads. But we're not going to see the major breakout that we've been expecting now, certainly since late December, early January, until the mud dries out. So there will be no sudden breakthrough and sweeping advances until late April, May, or June.
Wow. I mean, that is something that does not bode well for the success of what we are told I mean, it's just so completely opposite from everything we hear, that the Russians are running out of ammo, the Russians are depleted their resources, but you're suggesting it's the opposite, that the Ukrainian situation isn't looking very good for their long-term survival in this conflict, right?
Well, no, I don't. Listen, I don't think it ever has. I think what's worked well is the individual courage, strength, and endurance of the Ukrainian soldier. We know historically the Ukrainians have always been good fighters. They didn't have to go to war to prove it, but they've proven it once again. The problem is, for what? What are they fighting for at this point? Virtually everything of any value in Ukraine is under Russian control. In other words, this is similar to an enemy that came into the United States and controlled the entire East Coast and then sat there. That's what the Russians have done. In other words, they've captured the scientific industrial base, the coal mines, the iron ore, the rare earths, the natural gas, the oil, everything. They're sitting on it. And that's not surprising, because the people that live in those areas are overwhelmingly Russians, and they speak Russian, so they're very happy to have the Russians there. But having captured that, Ukraine is left with a large agrarian sector, but almost nothing else, which means it now depends very heavily on anything that we manufacture or the Europeans manufacture. And the Europeans are effectively out of gear. They've sent most of what they have to send. The German defense minister recently said Germany really can't afford to send any more than it already has and what is promised, because if we do, we'll be defenseless. And I mentioned the other day to someone that people don't realize just how bad things are in NATO. The Polish army today could probably conquer Germany in a week, because the Germans just have no military power to speak of to stop them. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think that gives everybody an appreciation for just how weak Germany is. Germany has prospered with all this cheap natural gas and oil from Russia for decades, but it has also neglected its own military establishment to the point where it's almost defenseless. When you switch to France, as a good friend of mine who's a retired general in the French army says repeatedly, Douglas, the only thing the French army is prepared to do is go on safari in North Africa. In other words, the rest of the force is designed for all of this low-intensity conflict nonsense that we've been wasting time on for the past 25 or 30 years, ever since Desert Storm. So the bottom line is, yes, the Ukrainians are in a very, very bad situation. It's not going to improve dramatically, but they're going to dig in and subsequent locations and try to defend against what is coming in the spring. But I don't think we're going to see much in the way of a major Ukrainian counterattack. They were talking about a counteroffensive in the springtime. I don't think we're going to see much of that. We may see some localized attacks, but not much more.
Are they just out of people or out of weapons or just?
I would say all of the above, David, all of the above. When you look at the personnel side, we see in many, many units that have been reduced in strength from 100% down to 50% or 40% or 30%. The replacements are overwhelmingly boys, 15, 16, 17, some women, and men age 40 to 60. And they're not bad people. They only have perhaps 3 weeks of preparation or training, and they're essentially sent in to fill out these units. And the Russians refer to them openly as cannon fodder. In other words, they're not very capable. There are a few special units left with hardcore professional soldiers in them, but the majority no longer have those. The majority are very weakly populated with relatively new recruits who cannot be expected to endure the hardships that their predecessors did.
So, I mean, you said earlier, Bakhmut, there's an estimated 200,000 Ukrainians have died.
Not in Bakhmut, but over 200,000 Ukrainians have died in this war, Ukrainian soldiers.
Yeah,
it's probably much higher. I've seen estimates of 257,000. I mean, we don't know with absolute certainty, but people are over there in the hospitals and going to the grave sites, and they're able to identify large numbers of people. That's how we find out the truth, because the Ukrainian government isn't going to tell you they've taken these sorts of losses. I mean, we're in a war where the Ukrainian substitute lies for the truth. So they say, oh, no, the Russians have taken all these horrendous casualties. That's not true. We think the Russians have had about 80,000 casualties, probably 25,000 killed at the moment. And that's simply because they have this preponderance in missiles, rockets, and artillery. And 75% of the casualties inflicted on the Ukrainians come from artillery, rockets, and missiles, and drones. That's where the majority of casualties come from. They're not coming from tanks and armored fighting vehicles. They're not even coming from soldiers shooting at each other. Most of it is standoff attack. In other words, long range, medium range strike.
I see. I see. You know, when I look at this story in the Washington Post, I mean, it's pretty concerning about the safety that we're losing here in this country. The headline is in race to arm Ukraine, U.S. faces cracks in its manufacturing might. This is by Missy Ryan. And it's surprisingly critical of it has a tone of critiquing some of the facts on the ground there. That's surprising to me because I typically think of the Washington Post as pretty in favor of the D.C. establishment line on things. But it says here, research conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, shows the current output of American factories may be insufficient to prevent the depletion of stockpiles of key items the United States is providing Ukraine. Even at accelerated production rates, it is likely to take at least several years to recover the inventory of Javelin anti-tank missiles, Stinger surface-to-air missiles, and other in-demand items.
Yes. No, I think that's a very, very accurate article. And there are certain things that your viewer or your listeners need to understand. This year, we're closing in on almost $1 trillion for defense, $850 billion plus. We haven't even addressed the amount of money that goes into the intelligence systems and the black budget, which constitute billions of dollars. We have been spending a lot of money on defense. No one really knows where all the money goes. Every time we try to audit the Department of Defense, we give up because we simply don't know where all the money has gone. Now we're sitting around and we're discovering that the industrial base, which is a critical feature of national defense, has been languishing, has been allowed to rot, has been allowed to diminish in terms of its capabilities. And people are going to say, well, what happened? Well, if you start asking the generals and the admirals, if they can even give you a coherent answer, they're probably going to tell you, well, we don't really look into those matters. We just look into the major weapon systems and ships, aircraft, vehicles, and so forth, which is also true for Congress, because most of the immediate benefit to defense spending for people on the Hill or for the individuals who are invested in defense comes from the big ticket items, new ships, new tanks, new this, new that. No one is looking at the potential for a real war. Remember that since 2001, we've been chasing people in bedsheets with AK-47s and sandals, occasionally some command-detonated mines. You're not talking about serious opponents with armies and air forces, which is what we're dealing with right now in Ukraine and Russia. As a consequence, we're not prepared, and we have no surge capacity. We used to have the ability to say, all right, we're producing, say, 10 aircraft a month. We need to produce 50, and we could ramp up and do that. We can't do that right now. And most of the weapon systems that we want to rapidly ramp up and produce in greater quantities are complex, like these missiles. You just don't start producing Javelin missiles on an assembly line. Mm-hmm. You've got lots of people who are physically assembling the components to make these precision-guided weapons work. So we can't keep up. On the other hand, over the last decade or two, the Russians have focused their attention once again on their industrial base and their ability to rapidly ramp up, surge, and produce vast quantities of equipment and weapons and ammunition. So now they are operating 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, turning out huge quantities of ammunition, missiles, rockets, tanks, infantry fighting vehicles, artillery systems, and so forth. We can't keep up with that. And neither, obviously, can the Ukrainians, because they're dependent on us for supply. And what I just discussed doesn't even exist in most of Europe right now. Very few European states have much of an industrial base committed to the production of military equipment. They've given it up because the Europeans depend entirely on us for their defense.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. So we're not in a situation because of this conflict. We're basically putting ourselves in a very dangerous situation in terms of any type of attack, right? I mean, we don't have the resources. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you know, someone who's a military expert would say, oh, the things that we're low on, we don't really need right now. It's not an immediate thing. We have many other means of defense that are far more important that we have plenty of. So don't, you know, this is a false narrative to be alarmed about.
Well, we've historically relied very heavily on air power to compensate for weaknesses on the ground. Not enough troops and not enough firepower. And that's fine when you're dealing with a weak opponent, but now you're talking about an opponent who has an extensive theater, air, and missile defense system. And if we were to fly most of our aircraft against the Russians right now, we would take heavy losses. In other words, the days of flying with impunity are over. And we can't afford, in most cases, to lose a lot of aircraft and pilots because, frankly, we don't have that many to begin with on the ground. What you're pointing to, David, is very important, and everybody needs to understand this. When we made the decision to build up this Ukrainian force, which was aimed at harming Russia, and we spent 8 years plus doing that, we didn't think through the consequences of our actions. We continued to dismiss Russia as, you know, the well-armed gas station. Remember, it's a single commodity system. What can it do? Its economy is weak. Its social cohesion is poor. Its leaders are corrupt. Why are we worried about the Russians? Well, what we're discovering is the exact opposite. Russia was much, much more than just oil and gas. Russia is one of the major food producers in the whole world. It has an abundance of resources. So we haven't been able to do any harm to the Russian economy on the scale that we'd hoped. In fact, Russia is doing better now. Its currency is stronger now than it's been in decades. It's actually profited from this war. And it's refocused its exportation of food and resources to other countries, China, India, Africa, Southeast Asia, the Middle East. We didn't think through what we were doing. And now it's not just a question of ourselves, but we have a nation called Ukraine that's being destroyed. It's probably down to 18, 19 million people. Virtually all the women are gone and the children, and you're running out of manpower. Anybody who can get out is running out. And meanwhile, the Russian armed forces are larger than they've ever been, and they're being expanded to 1.5 million. Everything that underpinned, all of the assumptions that underpinned our operations from the beginning were false. Now we're in a very dangerous position.
And it doesn't seem like, it seems horrible to be sacrificing, you know, young kids, 15, 16, and 60 and 70. But, in, you know, I guess in their mind, some of these are being forced to the front lines to fill in units, like you said. And it's horrible to consider that, because a lot of these people, they don't have any choice. And then some of them, you know, they truly believe, you know, this is, I mean, and it is in some ways, you know, an existential threat from their opinion, right? I mean, if you're someone who believes that Russia
we got to go back to the beginning, David, and say, what was it that the Russians wanted? The Russians wanted Ukraine to be neutral. They did not want it to become part of NATO because they saw this dangerous force emerging in eastern Ukraine that was designed to attack them. They wanted the Russians who live in Ukraine to have equal rights before the law. The Ukrainians had essentially reduced the Russians to second and third class citizens. They were being oppressed. They were not granted equal access to resources and opportunity. The Russians simply said, look, this is a multinational state called Ukraine. You've got almost a third of your population is Russian, and wanted equal rights for those Russians. And then finally, they said, look, stop the nonsense about Crimea. Crimea has been Russian since 1776. Stop talking about retaking Crimea. Recognize the legitimacy of control of Crimea by Russians. Well, the Ukrainians refused to do that. And we backed them and said, no, don't do that. So finally, you know, exasperated with us because we pushed NATO to the very borders of Russia when we said we never would, and we put a dangerous force on their borders, which was preparing to attack them, they finally intervened militarily. But even when they went in, initially, they went in with a very small force with the intention to do as little damage as possible, because they thought that if they demonstrated they were serious, that we in turn would immediately say, all right, that's far enough. We don't want a war. No one wants a war. We'll negotiate an end to these troubles, and we'll find a new arrangement that works. Well, the Russians were wrong, and they discovered this. And basically, by the summer, it was obvious that no one was going to be honest with them and negotiate with them. So they changed their approach, and they decided to organize for total war, real war. Yeah. Well, that took a few months. They're ready. They've got it. They're ready to wage total war. We're not. The Ukrainians are worse off now than they've ever been. So it's a tragedy for everyone. But no one in Washington is interested in bringing it to an end. And it's very dangerous, because the longer this lasts, not only is the worse is it for Europe and Ukraine, but there's always the danger that we will do something stupid and be drawn into this. Remember, we put a lot of forces in Poland. We've got 50,000 troops there. And then we have another 50,000 spread in Lithuania and down in Romania. The Poles have mobilized about 200,000 men, and they've got about 50,000 to 70,000 ready to fight. I don't know what the situation is in Romania, but we have evidence that the Romanians have some number of forces ready to go with us. And there is still talk behind the scenes about intervening on the ground in Western Ukraine with this conventional force. Well, the Russians are up to, what, 740,000? And they're still building and still mobilizing and still equipping and still turning out new equipment and weapons and capabilities. This is a catastrophe. We don't want to be drawn into this. We don't want a wider war. But no one is willing to step forward and say enough's enough. We need to end this and find some sort of arrangement with which all the sides can live. No one will do it.
So Washington wants this war to continue more than Poland and so forth, these other neighbors?
Well, I think the Poles believed from the beginning everything that Washington said, and assumed that the Russians would have long since collapsed and we would have scored some sort of victory against the Russians using Ukrainian manpower. That never happened. And I think the Poles are beginning to see the danger. Initially, the opinion polls supported war with Russia. Now they're starting to turn. And I think there are members of the Polish government that are beginning to question the wisdom of intervening. But you still have a majority there in the government that does want to take on the Russians, would like to go in and occupy some of the territory, which, you know, from their standpoint, they controlled for hundreds of years and lost as a result of the Second World War. Now, I don't know how serious that is, but I think that the danger of something like that occurring and involving us with our forces on the ground is huge. And I don't see any evidence that we, or for that matter, the Germans or the French or anybody in Europe, let alone the United States, is interested in going to war with Russia. I just don't see it. I haven't seen it in the polls. And I don't see Americans cheering on the movement of hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops to Eastern Europe to fight the Russians in Ukraine. I don't see it. So the question is, if there's really no support for that, what do we do? And I think the plan right now is to let this thing run. And now I'm beginning to see new distractions. Now we're starting to talk about the evil Chinese and the China threat. And now we even have Lindsey Graham saying we should attack Mexico. I mean, it strikes me as ludicrous nonsense. We started this war in Eastern Europe with the Russians. We don't want to end it. We're afraid to finish it in some way that'll make us look bad. And so now we're turning to other areas of the world where we want to create hostilities. It's insane. We can't afford any of it. Our economy is in terrible shape.
And of course, Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida, is trying to push a bill, I think this week, to try to use the war powers to resolve the Syrian troops. I didn't even know we had troops still in Syria, but I guess, you know, that's still going on over there. So is that something that they could they go and scapegoat Syria to try to save face and punch on somebody else for a little bit?
Look, there was an attempt. There was a vote in the House about removing troops from Syria, and all of the lobbies, foreign and domestic, everyone with an interest in the defense industries. My impression is the Israel lobby and other lobbies all gathered together and said, no, we cannot leave Syria under any circumstances. And so the Congress, which responds to the people that donate to their reelection campaigns, voted against it. I think we have 800 to 1,000 people on the ground in Syria. It's an illegal occupation, but of course, you know, we don't pay any attention to international law unless it suits our purpose.
Why is Assad tolerating it? He just is not bothering him or something?
I think Assad has had trouble just holding on to his own country and maintaining himself in office. He's not in a position to challenge the United States militarily. And we can always support those troops on the ground with enormous air power.
And which part are we occupying where there's assets and resources?
It's over in the northeastern side of Syria, down to the very southern tip that touches Iraq. There's a whole strip of land there that had some oil on it. You recall that there people talked about, well, we have the oil wells now that are up in these areas, and that'll help offset the cost, which, of course, is nonsense, never did. And we have collided there with the Turks, with the Russians, and we variously claim that we're there to protect Israel's interests, although from personal experience, the Israeli Defense Force is very competent, as is the Mossad. I'm not sure we're doing them very many favors, but that's neither here nor there. We think that we're protecting the Kurds, and of course, there are Kurds that want to use us. You know, again, this is a sort of wag the tail story. Wherever you go in the world, when you're a power like the United States, you're visiting. We don't live there. And everybody wants to use us for their agenda. And you have Kurdish elements that want to fight with the Turks. You have Kurdish elements that want to fight against Assad. You have Kurdish elements that are friendly to the Turks. Yeah. You know, you still have elements of Islamist terrorists operating there that are supported, incidentally, by Mr. Erdogan in Turkey. That the Russians have been trying to eradicate. We tried to eradicate them. We're sort of in a stasis mode there. But the real question is, why are we there at all? Whose interests are being served? And we can point to other countries, but how is our interest served there? What is our strategic interest? No one addresses it. Well, that's because, truthfully, we have no strategic interest there.
It's ridiculous. The whole thing. I you mentioned China, and there's a story in Nikkei, the Japanese outlet, Nikkei Asia, says behind Ukraine peace proposal, China foresees into war in the summer. And it talks about how, China unveiled its 12-point peace plan on February 24th, exactly a year to the day Russia launched its invasion. The proposal called for an early ceasefire and for both sides to restart negotiations towards a peaceful settlement. It says the plan itself is prosaic, but it gave the impression that China was suddenly playing an active role. The reason for China's sudden change can be traced back to a report issued 2 months earlier by a top think tank in Beijing. The Academy of Military Sciences reports directly to the People's Liberation Army, and it issues these recommendations and reports that this completed the simulation on the Ukrainian conflict, resulting in astonishing findings. So why are they having an about face in terms of their desire to make a quick peace, resolution here?
Well, the Chinese have a program that we refer to as One Belt, One Road. And the idea has been for some time to restore access to China across Central Asia into Europe, into the Middle East, into South Asia, Europe, Iran, and also to Africa, overland. That overland stretch of transportation networks once existed and worked very effectively. It was referred to broadly as the Silk Road because the Chinese were exporting silk. Today, obviously, the Chinese have an interest in exporting all sorts of goods, but also importing things and establishing lines of communication that reach to Europe. If the Chinese can do this, this dramatically reduces their dependence on the oceans. Right now, China depends very heavily on the arrival of everything they need through their ports on the Pacific Ocean. Well, that means that they are at high risk of being blockaded in the event of any crisis or conflict by the United States. We ultimately control the maritime environment, and we control the oceans. There's out in those oceans, there's almost no Navy but our own. Now, the Chinese have improved their position, but about a third of all of their ships are really Coast Guard vessels. The Navy is not truly a high seas fleet in the American sense, and their submarine fleet rarely strays very far from Chinese waters. They don't have the depth of experience, nor are they likely to get it. So the bottom line is, if you're Chinese, what you want are these overland routes. Now, the Russians have been cooperating with the Chinese to ensure that Central Asia remains stable. The Central Asian stands that we refer to all the time generally have very good relations with Moscow. They tend to trust Putin and Moscow. They do not trust Xi and the Chinese. That has its roots in a long, long history that we don't need to recover or rediscover here. But the bottom line is that the Russians have been helping to stabilize that. Along comes this horrible Ukraine war. And remember that many of those rail lines, not just pipelines for natural gas and oil, but also rail lines that will carry goods and services back and forth. Those rail lines have to go through Ukraine and White Russia in order to reach the ports in Western Russia and Europe. So you've got to have peace in Ukraine. The Chinese want to get this war over with, and they're willing to invest very heavily in Ukraine to restore the country to the extent that they can in order to stand up this commercial network. The Russians, of course, are trying to do the same thing. I mean, this is the big lie in the United States, is that somehow or another, Russia and China want war with us. The truth is the opposite. They're not interested in war with us, and in fact, they're not really interested in war with anybody. The Russians would like to do business with Europe, and the Russians would profit enormously from this network across Central Asia that China wants to build. And it's doing a land office business with China. The Chinese aren't interested in going to war with anybody for the same reason. You can't do business. If you can't do business, you can't prosper. You can't make money. You can't improve your position in the world. Bottom line is, China will do whatever it can to foster some sort of peaceful outcome to this war. But at the same time, they've also looked at the reality on the ground, and they know once the mud dries, once the ground is trafficable, the Russians will sweep forward, and this war will probably end this summer. That's probably true. And, you know, I don't know how it will end. I think the worst thing that could happen for us would be if the Russians swept all the way to the Polish border. But that may yet happen because of our unwillingness to negotiate with them on any circumstances. And we keep refusing to neutralize Ukraine, even though I think neutrality would ultimately turn out to be very profitable for Ukraine, specifically given what you and I just discussed, this massive commercial network, rail lines, transportation, movement of goods and services back and forth across the Eurasian continent. Remember, this is the land island. This is the biggest landmass in the world. And the entire Eastern Hemisphere is interested in seeing this come to fruition, this One Belt, One Road. They don't feel threatened by it. We, on the other hand, do. And we've been trying to do everything we can to block trade with China in Europe and block it elsewhere whenever we can. But it's not going to work very well. People are going to trade whether you like it or not.
Well, it seems like basically it's the military industrial complex and banking interests against the interest of everybody else in the world and the planet, right? You know, it's like everybody else just wants to trade and travel. You know, Americans and Russians don't have deep animosity, except for the people who believe in the Russia collusion psychological operation that the United States government did on the people for years. But that's kind of a fringe group when I think you look at the majority of Americans. They don't have a deep hatred for Russian people, and Russians don't have it for them. And the same thing goes for Chinese. I mean, Chinese people want to come here and study, and they're interested in our culture. They're interested in our music, whether it's good or bad. I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're not naturally hostile. It's these military industrial interests that have oligarchic control over governments, especially ours, because that's what we've made our bread and butter in, is being the world's crooked cop, that hold all of this back, you know, that we can't just have trade and travel and dialogue with Russia and China and a fair trade with these countries. We have to have this urgent sense of hostilities around every corner that just holds everything back.
Well, David, I think that's part of it. But I think first you have to understand that we have dominated the planet with our financial system, certainly since the end of the Second World War. And as a result, we want to ensure that Russia and China and India and other countries are assimilated into the financial system that we control. That's part of the reason for our opposition to Russia and China. These efforts have failed. In fact, right now it looks as though 3.75 billion people on the planet will stop using the dollar to do business. That's the response to this Ukraine war. In other words, the very opposite of what we hope to accomplish. Again, we were trying to drive people into submission. The people are not submitting. They're finding a way around us. We're going to end up dealing in the future with 3.75 billion people who will operate with currencies that are pegged to gold. That's what's shaping up in Russia and China and India. We, on the other hand, are going to be outside of that with our system. Whether or not it will still be dollar dominated or some other means will come into existence, I don't know. But that's a big factor here. Secondly, everyone in Washington is short term in their thinking. No one thinks much beyond the next election. No one thinks much beyond whatever is important to them today. There is no one who sits there and says, where do we as Americans want to be financially, economically, militarily in 10 years? Everything's about spend now for X, Y, or Z. Ambassador Chaz Freeman, he was the former ambassador to China and Saudi Arabia, has said repeatedly that every 4 years we tend to lobotomize Washington. And I think that's true. We give everybody a lobotomy. Whatever happened under the previous president is no longer of interest. We're going to build the brave new world with the new administration. So there is no long-term strategic thinking at all. Now, this was not an issue for us before the First World War, because frankly, the government in Washington, I don't want to say it was irrelevant, but it was certainly not the centerpiece of American national, industrial, and economic development. Most of the development was from the ground up. And that even persisted after the First World War for a while. And when the government did become involved, it was not always bad. There were good things that were done, but they were on the margins, tinkering on the margins of a larger scientific industrial expansion that began right after the Civil War. And it was not driven by the government per se. Well, those days are over. We don't live in that kind of world anymore. We have to have borders that are real. We cannot allow millions of people to migrate into the country whom we did not invite, whom we can't afford to support, and who may have hostile intentions toward us. We, you know, that's just insane. It's worse than suicidal. That's a huge problem. All you have to do is take a look at your large cities to see what happens when you don't enforce the law, when you don't actively fight criminality. And then finally, there's the armed forces. Our armed forces are not in good shape. They're in terrible shape. I used to cringe when I listened to President Trump, and he would say, we have the greatest armed forces in the world. Well, look, Mr. President, I know that you love our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and you're very proud of the armed forces, but I wish we'd scale back this talk because we are not what we were 30 years ago. In Washington, people don't seem to understand that the military power that they saw wielded successfully in 1991 no longer exists. You're talking about a time when there were thousands of aircraft from the Air Force and the Navy. You're talking about a time when the Army was still over 800,000 strong and then was subsequently dramatically reduced down to 495,000. I watched as 163,000 combat veterans left the service because there was no room for them anymore, and they willingly left with bonuses for their great work. Well, that's fine, but what were we left with? We were left with a smaller version of an old force. And that's what you've got everywhere right now: Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines. Now you add to that the social engineering problems that have gotten way out of control. They were always there. They were always a problem, but today they are fatal in their impact. And this administration is delighted with it. Doesn't seem to understand that on the one hand, you want to wage war against anybody who doesn't agree with you and will not submit to our financial domination. On the other hand, the means with which you once had the ability to enforce have vanished. Those means are just not what they were 30 years ago. Yeah. And I don't know what we can do to get the American people to understand that simply throwing money at defense is not an answer. We don't even know where the money goes. We can't audit the Department of Defense. And we know that we're wasting huge quantities of it. And in the meantime, lots of people on the Hill, lots of people in the private sector, people in certain districts and states are growing wealthy as a result. The problem is we're not improving our defense posture. So we're witnessing a much larger problem than just what's happening in Ukraine. Yes, Ukraine is being destroyed, but the American people are not getting the rest of the picture. Our potential opponent, if you want to call the Russians that, is far stronger now than it has been in decades. Its armed forces are modern. Its capabilities are impressive. And we don't want to go to war with these people. There's no reason for us to go to war. We don't have any reason to go to war with China. If you want to stop the Chinese from stealing your intellectual property, throw them out of our corporate laboratories, get them out of our universities. If you want to stop the fentanyl from pouring into the United States, don't bomb China. Close the border. Put the 40 or 50,000 troops that we've got in Poland on the border with Mexico. Stop it. Then go after the people inside the United States who are supporting these networks of drug dissemination and distribution. Go after them. Restore the rule of law in our major cities. Don't bomb Mexico, because if you bomb Mexico, if you go after the drug cartels in Mexico right now, your borders are wide open. The criminality in the United States is unchecked. We'll end up with a war inside the United States that's worse than the war in Mexico. So these are just stupid, uninformed commentary. Again,
I've always wondered, would the cartels employ Al-Qaeda style terroristic attacks in America if they wanted to, you know, blowing.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. You're absolutely 100% right. They're much better armed than the National Guard.
Yeah.
They're much better armed than our Border Patrol. The Border Patrol will tell you that. They would love to see the Army back on the border. We were there for 100 years. The United States Army maintained forces on that border for 100 years. Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur, everybody served on the Mexican border. This is people just don't understand. This is not a new problem. It was because Mexico has always had difficulties controlling its own problems with internal criminality. And we had to stop it from spilling into the United States. Well, now we've opened the floodgates. And it's not just Mexico. It's coming up to us all the way from Venezuela and Colombia and through Central America and from Cuba. And nobody seems to want to address these realities. But you don't just start bombing people, you know, because you say, well, we've got to punish the drug cartels. The Mexican government is an organized crime state. They're not going to help you. The Mexican army is part of the cartel system. Why wouldn't they be? The cartels have all the money. anybody who wants to survive in Mexico is on somebody's payroll. The government can't compete with that.
I wonder what drug cartels have relationships with our own government, though. You know, I mean,
well, we know that the police organizations in the United States, all the way up to and including Washington, are in fact infiltrated by the drug cartels.
So how could we ever even possibly, I mean, realistically, in our current corrupt system, how could we even properly wage a drug war when so much of the systemic corruption from local police to like you said, federal agencies having corruption within their structures from the top down, you know?
Well, you just answered the question why the so-called drug war begun many, many years ago in the Clinton years in earnest had no impact. It was just a facade. You're absolutely right. But can these things be stopped? Can we turn these things around? Yes, I think they can be done. But you're talking about very harsh measures that have to be taken. And you're talking about using police power and military power to regain control of our streets, our neighborhoods. I mean, who would have thought 30 years ago that a beautiful city like San Francisco would turn into what it's become? Incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia was bad in the 60s and the 70s. It's much worse now. Everything that was once a problem has metastasized into a serious cancer. Either we deal with it or ultimately we go under. And I don't think Americans really want to come to terms with that yet. They know it in many cases, but there are many Americans that sit in places where things seem to be quite good. And they say, well, I'm comfortable here in eastern Kansas. I'm doing fine in Montana. Things aren't bad in Maine, where I live, or western Connecticut. So what's your problem? We have a very large country. The problems are not uniform. But when you look at the large cities and you look at the concentrations of people who are dying from fentanyl, put that picture together and suddenly you realize you've got to do something much, much more stringent, much more intrusive than what we've been doing. But instead of focusing on these things, we have an attorney general that talks about white supremacy as being the leading cause of every ill in the world and every ill in America. Insane. You know, this. How do you deal with that kind of ideological blindness? I don't know the answer. But I do know that if we don't take action, this country may not make it.
Yeah.
And it's not going to go under because of our spending on Ukraine. That doesn't help us. That just exacerbates the problem. But just remember, go back to something you said, David. When you look at the Congress, they are willing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on this fiasco in Ukraine. They're willing to spend money for an alleged defense of this island of Taiwan that may well vote itself into China because they've got two parties on Taiwan. One's pro-Chinese, the other's pro-Japanese. The pro-Chinese party is probably going to come to power next. They may well vote to join China. You know, we don't know what's really happening politically in Asia. But we'll spend all sorts of money on that. But look at the United States. 100,000 Americans die of fentanyl poisoning, and no one will close the border. No one will complete the barrier on the Mexican border. No one wants to commit military power to defend this country. We'll defend Ukraine and Poland, but we won't defend America. What's wrong with that?